It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we take a trip to outer space and learn about the images of Jupiter and the universe that the James Webb Space Telescope has shared so far. First, the number of local newspapers in the U.S. continues to shrink, and there have been big staffing cuts at many of the remaining outlets. A study conducted by Northwestern University found that more than 360 papers have shut down since 2019, in some cases creating areas without local coverage that are being called news deserts. Earlier this month, the media company Gannett laid off dozens of newspaper employees around the country, including outlets here in Wisconsin. What does this decline in local news coverage mean for political, economic, and social issues in our communities? You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen local news coverage change in your area? Has your community lost a paper? Do you subscribe to an actual physical paper or it's descended in website form? Call it at 800-642-1234. Do you think local issues in your community get the coverage they need and deserve? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You could also email ideas@wpr.org. Kathleen Bartson-Culver is the James E. Burgess Chair in Journalism Ethics, Associate Professor in the UW-Madison School of Journalism, and Director of the Center for Journalism Ethics. Katie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much. I always love being here.
As I lay out some of those numbers, it seems pretty bleak. Are you seeing this as a area of concern, a crisis maybe even when it comes to local news coverage?
Oh, it's a massive area of concern. For those of us who value staying informed within our communities and, to be honest, staying connected with other people in our communities, losing neutral news outlets is a big threat to all of us, and we should all be worried about it.
Now, I mentioned those layoffs at Gannett, the chain that owns lots of newspapers around the country, including many around Wisconsin, wasn't making a lot of money, they said. So this round of layoffs came about. Why do you think a chain like Gannett and other chains like it are having some financial difficulties and also resorting to layoffs?
Oh, there are a lot of problems that they've been facing for a little over two decades. One of them, the loss of classified advertising revenue, which most people don't understand, was really an important part of, it was an important leg of the revenue stool for local newspapers. So when things like Craigslist or job postings on Monster.com came online in the late 90s and early 2000s, it just ate that revenue stream alive for local news outlets. And then the other thing is that advertising revenue for display advertising, so car dealerships and restaurants, is also massively down over that same period. So those are real difficulties. Just in the last year, newsprint costs are up by close to a third for those outlets. So it's just, you know, they just keep getting hit from all sides. The one cost that hasn't gone up is labor costs. Labor costs for the journalism. You know, it's not like we've been seeing massive pay increases or that journalists are, you know, particularly well paid. A lot of them are doing it as a public service. But also outlets like Gannett or organizations like Gannett have found real difficulty in delivering newspapers. They can't get labor, particularly throughout the COVID crisis and following, to deliver papers to people's homes. So that's a problem as well. They're just getting hit from all directions.
We're seeing some of these chains get bought out or merged with other chains, and private equity firms getting in on the game, trying to buy outlets like Lee Enterprises, which includes the Wisconsin State Journal and La Crosse Tribune, among others. How important is the emergence of private equity in the newspaper business? How big a deal has that been?
It's a huge deal, and it's a scary deal. You know, Lee has fought back against being acquired by private equity. You've seen journalists flee organizations that were similarly acquired. I think there are strong arguments that the Chicago Tribune, for instance, has been perhaps irreparably damaged by its private equity owners. So, you know, Gannett, as hard as this, you know, they reported about a $50 million loss in the last quarter, and then that's what resulted in the layoffs. They're a publicly traded company that gives us an eye into their financials that we don't get in the way these other organizations are held. So private equity is something to keep an eye on. If it comes to your town, I would be worried.
Now, we've got a few haves in the national press. We got the New York Times, Washington Post, and Wall Street Journal seem to be doing pretty well. Always seem to be adding staff. What is it that's driving what looks like success in these national newspaper outlets as compared to the local ones we're talking about?
So the national outlets have managed to make the Post and the Times are a little bit more alike than the Wall Street Journal. The Wall Street Journal can command subscription rates that other outlets cannot command just because of the specialized nature of their content and the fact that it's often businesses that are paying for the subscriptions rather than individuals. So if you're working on Wall Street, you know, your hedge fund is paying for you to get that subscription. But those large outlets have not fared as poorly with the loss of display advertising. So they generally have a lot of support from luxury brands, and luxury brands haven't suffered as much. So while your local jeweler may no longer be able to afford an ad in the Wisconsin State Journal, Tiffany can still run an ad in the New York Times. They also have done better at scoring revenue from digital. They've made a stronger conversion to like a digital first strategy, and people have been showing up, and their subscription revenue from digital is doing quite well. In the case of Washington Post, getting acquired by Jeff Bezos gives you quite a nice cushion as well.
Talking to Katie Culver, UW-Madison journalism professor, looking at more declines in local newspapers, the print and web versions of them, affecting Wisconsin, affecting the whole country, cuts in journalism staff, sometimes reductions in service, sometimes full-on closures. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on this, your questions for our guest. Maybe your experiences in your own community. Are you seeing less local media coverage where you are? What does it mean to you? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Katie, what does a local community lose when it loses a newspaper outright or sees it, you know, kind of hollowed out?
Well, some research shows us that what it loses is a sense of each other as people, and that polarization increases. So when you lose local news, news becomes nationalized. People pay more attention to national outlets, the national networks, the Times, the AP, USA Today, which is also a Gannett property. And when we're thinking about things on that national scale, we tend to move more toward our poles. So we move further apart than when we're paying attention to coverage of the local soccer team and coverage of the new cupcakery on Main Street. Those are the things that bring us together as people, because they're not just about left and right and you know, arguments over, you know, policy, over taxes, over that sort of thing. So, you know, there is a strong concern for me and plenty of other people that the loss of local news results in nationalization, and that amps up polarization. And that's really, really difficult. The other thing I would say is when we lose those watchdogs in our community, it allows powerful institutions to get away with some things that they ought not get away with. You know, sadly for Gannett, they had a, you know, there's really, we've all lost sight of the tremendous local journalism that's been going on because we're all paying attention to these layoffs. You know, there's a pretty good argument that none of us would have known about the police delays at the horrible mass shooting in Uvalde if it hadn't been for a local newspaper asking really difficult questions about why it took so long. You had law enforcement officials not telling truths about that situation to their community, and journalists demanding those truths. So, you know, there's so much important work that goes on the ground. Trust me when I say, as much as people in journalism can make mistakes, we're all human. We are not enemies of the people. We're trying to protect the interests of our communities and keep other institutions accountable.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Margo is with us in Menominee. Margo, what did you want to share with us?
Hi, I'm a former newspaper editor, and I'm retired now, age 66. And guess what I was just doing at the library? I was writing a frequently asked questions list for our national health care referendum that will be voted on November 8th in Dunn County, Wisconsin. So we've just, you know, as journalists, as truth seekers, we've got to continue. We are fighting for our democracy right now.
Margo, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Katie.
I really appreciate that, Margo, and please keep doing that. Libraries, I think, are community centers that are, just growing ever more important as ways for us to see each other. A few weeks ago, got a message from a group of citizens who do not have past careers in journalism, but are so concerned about what's going on with they live in what has become a news desert, and they wanted to know how they could fund a journalist, how they could bring someone into their community to keep an eye on the county board and the city council and local business. So people like you do make me optimistic. I think people like me and others need to supply resources for citizens who are concerned that they're living in a place with no local news and they want to contribute to it. You don't have to be in a Gannett newsroom to be sharing important, verified information in your community. A lot of that happens on Nextdoor, Facebook groups, and, really honestly, at the local coffee shop. My dad got a lot of his verified news at a barbershop. So I think citizens caring about having verifiable information to base their decisions on is critically important. And I congratulate Margo and these other folks for their efforts.
Thanks for that call, Margo. We're talking to journalism professor Katie Culver from UW-Madison about the continued decline of local newspapers, the impact it's having in our communities. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Where do you go for local news? Are you able to find it? Are you able to find quality local reporting in your neck of the woods? Do you wish you had more? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with Katie Culver, journalism professor at UW-Madison, director of the Center for Journalism Ethics, with us today looking at the decline of local newspapers and the consolidation of news into larger media outlets, and what that means for communities. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How important is local news coverage to you? Did you see a decline of it in recent years in your area? Do you wish you had more of it? Have you worked in local news coverage? What have you seen change over the years? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Katie, do you see promising models out there to fill in that role of the local newspaper, even if it isn't necessarily, a newspaper you can fold over and do the crossword in?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, Rob, and it's one worth making over and over again, is that, we shouldn't be tied to defending something just because that's the way it's always been. So the model that we've had for a few decades of publicly traded newspaper chains serving communities, maybe that isn't sustainable in the long term. Maybe we need to have other models. Things like public radio, for instance, are incredibly important in serving communities. Is that something that can fill in these news deserts? Are individual community members working to try to serve their neighbors with verified information? There are a couple of efforts that have me more optimistic than pessimistic. One is a group called Report for America, and they seek grant funding to put local news reporters in newsrooms. They support the salary for those reporters. It's kind of a sliding scale downward, so they fully support it the first year, 80% the second, and it goes down from there. And what that does is embed these journalists in these communities with the hopes that the local news organization will keep them on past when the grant runs out. There's also a local news network through ProPublica, which is also an endowed reporting effort that has done just really terrific work. And both of these are doing work in Wisconsin, which is interesting. There are some great sort of startup-minded news outlets in the state. I'm particularly fond of the work of the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, which publishes at wisconsinwatch.org. They are a really interesting group. They have grown in size. They're sort of busting at the seams in their offices because they've done very well in building support for their organization. Their investigative reporting is really making differences in this state. And so those things have me optimistic. Those are models that I would point to.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Jay is with us in Cloquet, Minnesota. That's a new one to me, Jay. Did I say that right?
You did, yeah. I'm actually driving past it, so I might not be there anymore.
Okay. Tell us what did you want to talk about?
I used to work at City Pages, which was the alt weekly for 40 plus years in the Twin Cities. And it was shut down in late 2020. And myself and three of my colleagues there launched our own alt weekly style digital newsroom called Racket about exactly a year ago, with more of a subscription model. And so far, so good. We're without any other kind of path to keep an alt weekly presence in the Twin Cities, we just had to create our own. And our mortgages and rents are paid, and we're kind of bringing that style of journalism back to a market that we felt very much needed it.
Jay, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. I think I've seen that in other communities, Katie. Weeklies, when I gave that number of papers that shut down, many of them were weeklies. But in some cases, alums from those papers, like Jay, are starting up a successor website to them.
Yeah, again, congratulations to Jay. You and Margo have the same positive energy that really makes me smile. I think it's a tremendous service that you're doing. You know, when I talk with students about this, you know, or actually when parents come with their high school seniors to tour the journalism school and they say, do I really want Lindsay to go into this? And I say, look, I really think that this is a gateway to so many opportunities in public communication. Yes, maybe you'll go into a traditional local TV station, but maybe you'll end up doing a video blog for a nonprofit. And all of that is providing information as long as it's done with ethics, with integrity, and with a commitment to truth telling. That's all an important part of what we need as citizens to make decisions in our lives. What I think the Gannett layoffs illustrate is kind of the nobility of journalism, so it's necessary for democracy versus the business of news. So the fact that Jay is able to pay his mortgage and make a decent enough wage to survive on, that's great. He's not trying to wring year-on-year profits out of his new alt-weekly startup. Maybe at some point he'll be like the CEO of Gannett, who's making almost $8 million a year, to be losing $54 million a year for his company. But we need to think about the importance of democracy and the centrality of journalism to that. And that has to be separated away from some of those profit concerns. You know, a lot of people really express empathy and concern about coal miners. They are losing their jobs to a conversion to cleaner energy because of the climate crisis. But it's a little bit hard to count in journalism. It's a little bit hard to count in coal mining. But there's a strong case to be made that we've lost more jobs in journalism than we have in coal mining. And I'd love to see people caring as much about this. And so someone like Jay, whose job went away, he's kind of like a coal miner who then, you know, makes the transition to work in a wind farm or at a solar farm. And that's what's going to happen in journalism. We're going to have new ways of looking at this and doing this.
Thanks a lot for that call. Randy joins us now in Preston, Minnesota. Randy, hi.
Yeah, hi. I listened to a podcast called Congressional Dish, and she's a kind of a nerdy woman who, she has spent a long time listening to congressional hearings and C-SPAN, and then she reports, like, she reads the bills that get passed in Congress, and it's a fascinating look into how our government works. And she brought up a proposal a while ago, and I think it'd be just great. There should be a statewide, each state should have its own congressional dish. People who...
Gotcha. Randy, we don't have too much time left, but I think I get the gist. Katie, can we hope for nerds finding, as Randy was saying, finding markets in states, but even in local governments, where maybe a podcast forum to really bring people into the nuts and bolts of how things work?
Yeah, Randy raises a fantastic point. Podcasts are also part of this, as long as they're dedicated to that truth-telling and they're working with ethics and integrity. But scaling these sorts of operations is what we need, so that, you know, there could be a Congressional Dish Wisconsin Bureau that is tracking what's going on in our state legislature for us. It would be great information to rely on. And if it's delivered with some entertainment and humor, I'm all there for it.
Thanks for that call. I know, Katie, there are efforts out there from, you've mentioned the need for sort of neutral groups to hold governments and others accountable. There are definitely efforts from conservatives to create things that look like local news outlets, some from the left as well. some corporate backed things like that. Are you worried that in the absence of, say, a local newspaper, we might see something less neutral, less reliable weasel in and take its place?
Absolutely. It's happening in every state in this country, and it's terrifying. And again, getting to the point of ethics, I have no problem with folks on the left or on the right trying to persuade people about their policies or their concerns about social issues. That's fine. Go ahead, make your argument, but be transparent about who you are and what you're arguing for and against. Don't try to put something over on local news consumers. You know, I study and teach journalism, and there are times that something will pop up in one of my social media feeds, and I don't have the first clue whether it's reliable or not. And I think that's just a shame what we're doing to our fellow citizens if we're trying to put something over on them. If you have an argument, make your argument and be upfront about where it's coming from.
Katie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And thanks to the callers. They have a smile on my face.
That's Kathleen Culver, the James E. Burgess Chair in Journalism Ethics, Associate Professor in the UW-Madison School of Journalism, and Director of the Center for Journalism Ethics. She was with us today for a look at the decline of local newspapers in many communities around the state and around the country. If you still have a story to share or just want to let us know what's going on in your community when it comes to actual local coverage, we'd still love to hear it. You can let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A million miles away from Earth, the James Webb Space Telescope is taking images of the universe, showing us what it looked like over 13 billion years ago, close to the Big Bang and the beginning of time itself. The latest images from the telescope are closer to home with a look at Jupiter, the biggest planet in our solar system. We're taking a look now at what we've learned from the James Webb Telescope, Jupiter and beyond. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following the saga of the James Webb Telescope? How about the images that have been coming out lately? Do you have a favorite? Do you have one you want to ask about? Call it at 800-642-1234. If you're a backyard astronomer, love to hear from you and what you've been looking at lately. 800-642-1234 is the number, or email ideas@WPR.org. Thomas Beattie is an assistant professor of astronomy at UW-Madison. He helped build the camera on the James Webb Telescope that took those photos of Jupiter we're going to talk about. Thomas, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me on.
And I should also say welcome to Wisconsin. You're brand new on the faculty at UW-Madison, I believe.
That's right. We just moved up here this month, so it's nice to be back up with trees instead of cactuses.
Well, we've got this welcome for you with these new images of Jupiter. What was your reaction to seeing these photos of the big planet using a camera you helped make?
It's super exciting. I think, you know, we have spent the last 7 months since JWST, the Webb, launched, checking out the instrument and making sure it worked. And now we're finally getting these amazing images from it of Jupiter and everything else in the sky. So it's very exciting to see this and see that it's performing as well as we could have hoped.
Before we dig more into Jupiter, I want to talk about the capabilities of this telescope. It seems like it's a game changer for astronomy. What is it that makes it so different than even, you know, the Hubble?
So the big difference for any telescope, the thing that matters is how big is the mirror? How much light can it collect? And the big difference between James Webb and Hubble is that James Webb has a mirror that is 10 times larger. And we also observe at different wavelengths. So this is giving us, you know, a 10 times roughly better view of what's out there in the universe.
I've heard the argument that in the future we're going to talk about astronomy before the Webb telescope and after. I mean, is it that stark a difference, do you think?
Well, you know, it's always hard to predict the future in science, but if I had to guess, I think that's exactly right. I think in 5 years, I think the textbooks are going to be completely different. I think that Webb is going to just blow everything out of the water compared to what we know now. So it's a very exciting time to be doing astronomy.
All right, let's steer us back toward Jupiter now, but not too close. It's big. What kind of things are we seeing in these images? What kind of things are we hoping to learn about Jupiter?
So in these images, what you can see is, so first off, you see the beautiful cloud bands on Jupiter that that we've seen before from spacecraft and from the ground and from Hubble, but we're really seeing them in a way that we've never seen before. We're observing at different wavelengths of light, so sort of different colors, which lets us see different parts of the atmosphere. And so we can see these bands of clouds, we can see the vortices in the clouds. That tells us about what the clouds are made out of, how the weather on Jupiter, works, which we don't understand very well. We also can see the auroras on the top and the bottom. That tells us about Jupiter's magnetic field. Ultimately, all of this is telling us about what is happening inside Jupiter. What is it made out of? How does its atmosphere work? And really what we want to try and get at is how is Jupiter formed? Because that really tells us about how planets are formed in the solar system and everywhere in the universe.
Yeah, it's a gas giant because it's big, gas because it's mostly gas. What is it that led to the formation of a gas giant, say, instead of a rocky planet like Earth or a star?
So that's a very good question, Rob, and something that a lot of people here at UW are working on right now. When planets form, sometimes they form into planets like Earth, sometimes they form into planets like Jupiter. The dividing line there is actually not well understood. There's actually a term, it's called runaway accretion, where if you get big enough, you can accrete gas, you can gather gas and form into a giant planet. And why some planets do that and why some planets don't is not something that's well understood at the moment. So it's something we're hoping to learn from images like these.
We are talking about the newest images from the James Webb Space Telescope. Thomas Beattie is with us from the Astronomy Department at UW-Madison. You can join in with your questions, what you've thought of the images so far, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Luke is with us in Duluth. Luke, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. Beautiful images coming from the telescope. So I've seen some articles saying that some of the discoveries from the Webb could call into question the Big Bang itself. I'm just wondering if there's any merit to that or to kind of expound on what that might be talking to. I don't know any of the evidence myself, so thank you.
Luke, thanks for the call. I've seen those notions going around there, and I've seen articles debunking the notion that it's debunking the Big Bang. Thomas, what does this tell us about the earliest days of the universe?
Well, so Webb is going to be really give us an exquisite view into the earliest days of the universe. Luke, to your question about whether or not it's going to debunk the Big Bang, I will say the Big Bang at this point, I think, is pretty settled. The Webb is not going to debunk the Big Bang. What it will do, though, is really allow us to push really close to that event and see for the first time some of the first stars and some of the first galaxies forming in the process of coming together, which is going to give us a much better idea of some of the timescales that are happening very early on in the universe's life and some of the mechanics of how the Big Bang occurred. But I think Webb is not going to disprove the Big Bang, but it will give us a much better understanding of what happened at very early times in the universe.
Luke, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. And Thomas, that reminds me of one of the mind-blowing things about looking deep into space that I sort of get and yet don't get. The further the distance the stars or galaxies we're looking at, the further back in time we're looking at. Do I have that about right?
That's right. It's a great game to play. We get to just sit here and watch the whole universe evolve around us. It happens because light travels. Light has a speed. It's 186,000 miles per second, which seems incredibly fast. But on the scales of outer space, that's relatively slow. It takes light 8 minutes to get to us from the sun. It would take several hours to cross the solar system. So when you look at these galaxies that are a billion light years away, that means that the light has been traveling to us for a billion years. So we are seeing them, the light that was emitted a billion years ago. So as you look further away, the light has required longer to get to us. And so that's why we can see, I'm doing air quotes, further back into the history of the universe. So it's an amazing trick that allows us to see the universe evolve around us without us having to really move anywhere or do anything. We just need to look up and see what the universe is telling us.
We're talking about the latest James Webb images. It was one of the scientists who helped build one of the telescope's cameras, the infrared one, Thomas Beattie, who's an assistant professor of astronomy at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about how we see into space, what we're learning from this new telescope, or a question about what we could learn from it? Have you been following the images? Have any struck you in particular that you maybe want to know more about? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Thomas Beattie, an assistant professor of astronomy at UW-Madison. He helped build the infrared camera on the James Webb telescope. We're talking about the images that camera has taken so far, what the images teach us about the universe. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Jack is with us in Madison. Jack, hello.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I love Central Time. I had a question. I'm wondering, what's next after James Webb? I know I'm getting a little far in the future, but is there any ideas of maybe another telescope, something more advanced, something maybe with a bigger mirror? That's my question. I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Jack, thanks. There's a long road to get to the Webb telescope. Thomas, what could be next?
That's a very good question, Jack. That's something that everybody in astronomy is thinking a lot about right now. So there is one mission that's going to come up, large mission. So usually things are divided up into sort of 10-year time spans for astronomy. The next one is going to be a mission called the Roman Space Telescope, which is going to look at really deep into the universe, really probe what's going on in other galaxies and how galaxies form. And after that, there's very general plans for sort of the next generation of Hubble and Webb, something that, you know, could be a 6 or 8 or 16 meter diameter mirror. Hubble is 2.4 meters and Webb is 6 meters. So something even larger than Webb, which would be very exciting, but that probably won't happen at least for another 15 or 20 years. These have pretty long lead times on these missions.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Thomas, I understand a lot of your research is looking for exoplanets. So planets like we have in our solar system, but in other solar systems. Do you have hopes that the Webb can help find some of those?
Yeah, it's funny. Looking at these Jupiter images, it's a much more closer to home version of what I work on day to day. So Webb, usually we're not going to be using it to – what we're going to be using it to is look at planets that we know are there, and we're going to look at their atmospheres. And so we're going to try and figure out what are these planets made out of. You know, usually when we find a planet, we know how big it is, how heavy it is, but we have no idea if it's got an atmosphere, if it's like the Earth, for instance, or if it's like Venus, which are very similar in our solar system. But Venus, if you land on it, your spacecraft melts 5 minutes later, but Earth is a nice place to visit. We're going to be looking at those. We're going to be looking at giant planets, and we're going to be trying to figure out what planets might be like the Earth, and we're going to be trying to better understand how planets are formed in general.
And did I see you wrote a thing on trying to detect something like Earth? Like if somebody else is looking for Earth, they might be able to find something interesting about us by looking at our night side and all the lights we've got. How would we look for that on other planets?
I did write something on that, Rob. So that actually goes back to that caller's question about the next generation space telescope. So some of the plans for the bigger next gen space telescope with the larger mirrors would be able to see night lights or city lights on the night sides of some of these planets. So we know that there are some potentially habitable planets that are about the same size as the Earth at about the right distance from their stars around nearby stars. And so with these next gen telescopes, we could look at the night sides, and if they're using city lights like we see here on Earth, we could possibly detect that emission. They'd have to have a lot more cities than on Earth, probably 10 times as much as we have on Earth right now. But that would be one way to, we call it a technosignature, one way to technologically determine that there's life elsewhere in the universe.
Now, NASA, we've been talking about images. NASA dropped an audio clip, apparently the sound of a black hole region. Now, this is, we're going to give a listen to what they released. This is bumped up 50-some octaves. The actual sound would be way too low for humans to hear. Here's a little taste of what they released. You probably had a content warning on this. It's kind of disturbing. Now, my I always thought, Thomas, there's no sound in space. Sound doesn't travel, but NASA says, no, it can. Why?
Well, you're right, Rob. They had to do some modification on this. So what we're listening to, what we were just listening to there, is in every galaxy that we see, there's a black hole in the center of it, including in our own galaxy, in the Milky Way. There's a big, giant black hole in the center of all the galaxies. And around that is all this gas that's falling into it. And on Earth, when we hear sound, what that is that's the air vibrating around us. So that's the reason why there's no sound in space, because there's no air in space. But if you have a black hole that has all this gas falling into it, what we're listening to is that gas does vibrate. There are pressure waves, exactly like sound in the air, passing through it. The big difference is that the sound that we just heard is, had to be stepped up in frequency by a factor of about 100 billion, I believe, to be able to be heard, right? It wouldn't be something we could hear. It's super low frequency. But if you step it up, then you get that super eerie sound that we were just listening to. That sort of is the sound of what a black hole makes.
On a practical level, if I'm an astronomer, I'm not, but if I was, and I wanted to get some time with the web to point it in the directions that I wanted to, what goes into that? How do you make that kind of reservation?
Well, Rob, you and I could write a proposal. So, I mean, the way it works is you write, anybody in the U.S. Can write a proposal, including you, Rob, or any of the listeners could write a proposal to NASA and submit it. And you just, you get 3 to 6 pages of text to argue for why you think you should be allowed to get some amount of time, 10 hours of James Webb time to point it where you want. And then it's actually relatively democratic. Those proposals go in, and then they get a bunch of other astronomers, usually people who have not written proposals for James Webb, to then review all of them and decide what gets selected and what isn't. And I've served on a bunch of those panels, like for the Hubble Space Telescope, where we review other people's proposals. And usually it's a pretty good discussion. So it's a pretty democratic system that usually ends up being pretty fair, but, there's always some outliers. But that's generally how it works. And it's a lot of work around proposal time, but you get good science out of it, so it's all worth it.
And just our last half a minute or so, what are you excited to learn next from the Webb Telescope?
Well, like I said, I work on exoplanets. I think our understanding of exoplanets, planets outside the solar system, what makes a habitable planet, how planets are formed, is going to be completely different 5 years from now than it is today. And we're just starting that journey literally like today. So it's a very exciting time to be a part of this field.
Thomas, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Thomas Beatty, assistant professor of astronomy at UW-Madison. He helped build one of the cameras on the James Webb Telescope. He talked to us about the pictures the telescope has taken so far, including those images of Jupiter and more. More than a century ago, nearly 200 Ojibwe graves were removed from the burial grounds on a strip of land offshore from Lake Superior. Now, Danielle Kading reports that members of the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa are celebrating the return of those burial lands to the tribe.
Lake Superior is calm as it laps against the shoreline at Wisconsin Point one sunny August afternoon. Every year for nearly 2 decades, descendants of Chief Joseph Osagi gather here to reunite. Some are meeting relatives for the first time. 99-year-old Osagi descendant Colleen Aird says being here this year is a real thrill because this year marks the first gathering since the Superior City Council approved transferring a small lot to the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. The site marks the tribe's burial grounds.
This is really home. Our roots are here.
Yeah, we have more family here.
How's it going?
At the gathering, a group of around 50 people share stories around a fire. Aird says her father told her about what life was like then in the one-room schoolhouse on Wisconsin Point.
They had a pot-bellied stove when it was cold, And he would have to build a fire in there to warm up the schoolroom. And then he'd have to row the boat over to Superior, and the teacher was waiting there.
The tribe settled on the sandbar stretching nearly 3 miles along Lake Superior as early as 400 years ago. By the mid-19th century, Chief Joseph Osagi was leading a small but thriving community there. In 1852, Osagi and other Ojibwe leaders traveled to Washington, D.C. to fight a presidential order forcing them from their lands. The trip resulted in the 1854 treaty that set up reservations in northern Wisconsin and Minnesota. Despite that treaty, says 66-year-old Osagi descendant and Superior native Lori Madden, in 1918, the community and the remains of her ancestors were wrongfully removed.
They took 198 graves and they moved them by scow down the Nemadji River to St. Francis Cemetery, where then they put them into the graves there.
The remains were reburied elsewhere to make way for U.S. Steel's plans to put up ore docks at the Superior port. Those docks were never built, and the removal was paid for with federal funds intended to benefit tribal members. More than a year ago, Superior City Council President Jenny Van Sickle launched an effort to return burial sites to the tribe. The council approved a resolution to transfer the lands in July last year. For Osagi families, the stories passed down about Wisconsin Point are treasured memories. Madden says the history of this place was lost to her and others.
My mom and dad did not share stories with us because of the fact of discrimination.
She and others recounted how fear of discrimination prompted their parents to keep quiet about their native heritage. Aird says her mother went to an Indian boarding school in Bayfield. Such schools focused on eliminating tribal lifeways and barred children from speaking their own language. Now, Aird's daughter, Pat Nelson, says her daughter, Veronica, has been learning about the culture and studying the Ojibwe language.
She's kind of bringing us back to those traditions.
About 2 weeks after the reunion, the Fond du Lac tribe hosted a celebration to mark the return of those lands, including a drum ceremony. Aird attended the celebration just days after her 99th birthday.
I never thought this day would ever come.
Van Sickle, an Alaskan native, says it's important to humanize places that can get lost in textbooks.
They're real people with stories. You know, native perspective, native voices are not optional, and there's a lot of work ahead.
Fond du Lac Tribal Chairman Kevin Dupuy looked on as Superior Mayor Jim Payne signed over lands to the tribe. Now, Dupuy says the work ahead may include a monument to replace pillars that currently mark the site. He searched for words to capture the feeling of the moment.
I just want to go in the woods. I think I should be at Wisconsin Point right now, or St. Francis Cemetery, telling them what we did.
Now, Dupuy says their people can finally be left to rest. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.